Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Jim Lance, and I'm the podcast host for discussions of books in African studies, as well as books on the Global South in general, and economic and political development. Today, I'm really pleased to have as my guest Todd Cleveland, assistant professor of history at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. I'll be talking with Todd today about his book, Stones of Contention, A History of Africa's Diamonds. I'll give this information again, but full and complete information about the book is available on the Ohio University Press and Swallow, Ohio University and Swallow Press website, Todd's publisher. The URL for that is www.ohioswallow.com. That's www.ohioswallow.com. And I encourage you to visit the website after our discussion to learn more about Todd's book. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to your book in general, I just want to say I was really, really, really impressed by its how well written it is and engaging.
Thanks.
And the narrative thrust of the book is really compelling, and it's a subject that has attracted a lot of attention, as your book brings out in both film and other media outlets. But so before we begin talking about your book in particular, could you please just tell us a little bit about how you became interested in African studies, your background that led you to pursuing your interests, and then specifically how you became interested in diamonds and writing about diamonds?
Sure. Gosh, how far back should I go here? My interest in Africa's studies is rooted in originally my interest in European history. When I was a master's student at the University of New Hampshire, I started working with Doug Wheeler, who worked on the works on the Portuguese colonial empire. And so gradually I transitioned from being essentially a European colonial historian to an African historian as I became increasingly interested in the African perspective of the colonial encounters. In particular, a trip to Guinea-Bissau in West Africa in 1997 constituted a sort of pivotal moment. My sister was a Peace Corps volunteer there, and I just had a wonderful trip, as many people describe. Their first visits to Africa, they were bitten by the African bug. And from that point on, I knew I wanted to focus on Africa rather than any sort of European history or European studies. So that's sort of the origins of my interest in African history in general or African studies. The diamond dimension to all this came about a bit later as a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. I was interested in pursuing a topic in labor history, wanted to stay within the Lusophone world, and so identified Angola, as a place to on which to focus. And there was, as some listeners may know, there was a protracted civil war in Angola that lasted roughly from 1974-75 until 2002. And so, among other tragic things, that precluded a lot of scholarly research or historical research in particular in the country. And so there was an array of topics available in a way to researchers that would have been pretty thoroughly combed through in other settings. And so there was, I was turned on to the Companhia de Diamantes de Angola, which is essentially the Angolan Diamond Company, which was a monopolistic corporation operating in Angola roughly from 1917 until 75, and even past 75, actually into the early 80s, although it was a shell of its former self by then. And this was an exciting topic. This was just something that no one had ever worked on, even though upwards of a million Angolans and other Africans toiled on the mines over the roughly six decades that the company was in existence. And so the next sort of set of formidable challenges were largely logistical, sort of how to get out to the diamond mines, how to identify former mine workers, so on and so forth. But that's sort of the genesis of my interest in Africa's diamonds. So it was purely Angolan originally. Of course, historiographically, I had to understand the sort of broader context, the Southern African mineral context. But my interest in Africa's diamonds started in Angola, certainly.
That leads us to a segue into your book itself. And as I said, one of the things I found compelling about the book, to me, it's not only a book about diamonds in Africa. It's as much a book about perceptions of what Africa is. With that thought in mind, I was taken by your title, Stones of Contention. To me, stones imply something that does not have any real intrinsic value. And so why would there be contention? So what brought you to come to that title, and why are these stones contentious?
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a good question. I originally, if I remember correctly, the working title was Turning Over Stones. I think we were just looking for a synonym for diamonds, actually. The idea was that we were going to really delve into the wide array of human experiences that go sort of under-examined in histories of diamonds in Africa, which has more of a sort of an industrial focus. We settled on Stones of Contention eventually because sort of at every turn, going back to the discoveries in South Africa in the middle of the 19th century, these stones or these diamonds always seemed to be at the heart of some sort of contention. There were very few sort of orderly or peaceful instances in which stones would, these diamonds, diamond deposits would be discovered, and then there'd be some sort of ensuing cooperation or collaboration or peaceful extraction of the stones. But every turn, there seems to be some sort of contention or some sort of tension or violence in many cases. And that's sort of the origins of the title. We lost in the transition from the original working title to this title was this emphasis on this wide array or range of human experiences associated with the extraction of diamonds. But I think the contention component of the title really does capture what the narrative is capturing and reflecting over the course of the chapters. And that's not to imply that it's this incessant violence that's been going on for 150 years. Of course, as you know, you've read it. There's some much more optimistic sections than that, but it did seem to be reflective of much of the book's contents.
Yeah, we'll get to the optimistic points, I hope, later on. But I would like to focus a bit on the notion of violence and contention a bit more. Another thing that really impressed me by your book was how you interwove popular culture, especially Western or Northern, if you want to call it that, perceptions of Africa, particularly the movie Blood Diamonds. And why had that? Why do you think that became such a big box office hit? And how do you think your book both counters and reinforces stereotypical notions of Africans as violent and backward that certainly came to the fore in the movie?
Sure. Diamonds are such a sort of fascinating entity in a way. I mean, they're so recognizable. They're sort of a part of so many people's lives, even if it's solely related to an engagement ring or something a grandmother passes down to a mother, and so on and so forth. There's an exotic dimension to diamonds as well. As you indicated, they have no intrinsic value, so this notion of them being so endowed with such value is also intriguing if you sort of stop to think about that as well. Of course, this notion of blood diamonds or this phenomenon feeds notions of Africa as a sort of inherently violent place. So it's reinforcing a narrative with which people are, or a misperception with which people are already familiar. I think that, so in some respects, I mean, the book does, the book's not necessarily corrective, but it is when I think it needs to be. I think that what I do over the course of the book is implicate so many other individuals, countries, leaders of foreign countries, so on and so forth, that although Blood Diamonds geographically was an African problem, there were so many other individuals involved in this process, external players that played important sort of contributory roles in either sparking or deepening these blood diamond crises on the continent. And ultimately, there were some important players who intervened to institute the Kimberley process, which in effect stemmed the flow of blood diamonds. So that there's an external story that's just as important in this sort of broader narrative of blood diamonds. And so I think that if we understand that this was a sort of a collaborative effort, it redirects some of the attention away from Africa even though geographically it remains largely, or it was a largely African problem.
Right. Well, that's another thing I'm glad you brought that point out, because that's another thing that really struck me, how really unfair it is that Africa itself has been solely attributed the blame for the violence and avariciousness that's taken place. And you bring to the fore a number of external actors.
I don't think you can understand the history of Africa's diamonds without placing them in a global context. I mean,
right.
I think that's imperative.
Well, since the book starts out with perceptions, how did Africa become, in Western perceptions, this place of untapped and unlimited wealth? And how does that relate, again, to the issue of diamonds?
Sure. Again, there's a chapter dedicated in the book to the sort of origins and genesis of these external notions of Africa as a treasure trove. And some of them are founded. Most of them are unfounded, let's put it that way. But these go back thousands of years, long predating the discovery of diamond deposits in South Africa. And so there's always, I shouldn't say always, but for millennia, there's been a notion that Africa's sort of has been an untapped treasure trove, a mineral treasure trove. And there are instances of these perceptions that are extant in writings from the Middle East, from the Far East, from Europe as well. One of the myths that sort of perpetuated or deepened this notion was the myth of Prester John, this legendary mythical Christian king who, again, allegedly, supposedly oversaw an empire that was as wealthy as it was powerful, and that was eventually located in the what's now Ethiopia at one point. So these further fed eager, zealous individuals from well beyond Africa's borders to seek treasures, to more aggressively seek these treasures on the continent. There are just any number of myths that I sort of outline in the book that fed these misperceptions, going all the way into the 19th and 20th centuries, and you could argue perhaps today still as well. So this has been a long process. This has been something that outsiders have. This has been a way that Africa has been perceived or misperceived for long, long periods of time, well before the discovery of diamonds.
When were diamonds discovered, and how did they become objects of value? Because that you also spend a goodly portion of your book talking about the processes of discovery, how diamonds are shaped into commodities of value,
sure.
Their uses, and can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, diamonds are discovered these original diamond deposits are discovered in South Africa rather innocently. In the 1860s, in the first instance, allegedly, by a boy who sort of, you know, casually picks up a stone, and, you know, three conversations later, they find out that it's an actual diamond, a reasonably good-sized diamond. From here, as you might imagine, things begin to spiral out of control. This comes at a particularly sort of propitious time, because just at this point, the diamond deposits in Brazil are becoming largely exhausted. And so that there's sort of a global shortage of diamonds, if you will. Again, they'd have no value at this point, really. This is well before they're being used for industrial purposes. So it's a shortage, may not be the most accurate way to describe the supply at that point. But there's sort of a logical transition from Brazil to South Africa, relatively seamless. I mean, it's almost literally just the Brazilian supply again, the value that's bestowed on the stones is something that predates the African discoveries. So going well back into time, millennia, in fact, for aesthetic reasons, almost solely, diamonds have been perceived as having value by different communities all over the world. So this isn't exclusive to Europeans or Asians or Africans, for that matter. In fact, Africans bestowed no value on diamonds to the extent that they even knew they were there. And so over time, there's almost immediately a rush to South Africa, analogous to the gold rush in the United States and Canada. that preceded this particular rush by only about two decades or so. And you see many of the same characters show up in South Africa, sort of rematerialize in South Africa, which is interesting. There's so many parallels to these two processes. It's sort of a longer history, but eventually they find the mother lodes, if you will, these very, very rich deposits, very close to where the original stones were found. And this becomes sort of the heart of the African diamond industry, and to a certain extent remains that, not the geographical heart necessarily, because that's moved to Botswana, though not too far away, but De Beers is still, there's sort of a long history here as to how De Beers takes over, and then eventually Anglo-American takes over. But nonetheless, it's still anchored. The company, the corporate entity, is still anchored in Southern Africa, and South Africa in particular.
While you're mentioning De Beers, leads me to my next question. How did De Beers become such a prominent player in the global diamond industry?
Sure. Well, we could talk for hours about this.
I know.
One man's vision, to a certain extent, Cecil Rhodes, had the presence of mind to realize that these were going to be extremely important, extremely valuable discoveries, and so he didn't come to South Africa from England as a rich man, but made a series of very prudent decisions, and it would be hard to argue that, you know, for all of his faults, perhaps, that he wasn't a visionary in this respect, because he really saw something that obviously others didn't. And again, he wasn't blessed with a great deal of initial capital. He started out very small. Over time, subsequent to Rhodes' death, De Beers, as a corporate entity, made some poor decisions and opened the door for Anglo-American, which was eventually run by Oppenheimer, to come in and actually take control over De Beers. And Anglo-American only retained the De Beers name for marketing purposes, essentially, because it was already a well-established company. So in many respects, De Beers would have a very short corporate history, roughly, we'd be talking a matter of decades here, had Anglo-American not decided to retain the name or retain De Beers as a subsidiary. So this may well have been a company we wouldn't be talking about at all in this day and age. But nonetheless, whether we want to call it De Beers or some sort of corporate entity or subsidiary within the Anglo-American corporate umbrella, they made a series of extremely aggressive moves to monopolize control of the diamond supply, and ultimately demand, which is really where the genius lies for me. Very aggressive, very ruthless corporate measures to make sure that they controlled the supply of diamonds. Very heavy-handed tactics in many respects. One of the interesting aspects of their approach to supply is that they never prospected. They never wanted to find new sources of diamonds because, of course, that would undermine this notion that this misperception that diamonds are rare. Of course, they're not, in fact, rare at all. It's just that De Beers was stockpiling most of them and only releasing to the market a very small percentage of them, thus rendering them rare, at least for purchase. Later on, there were a number of other competitors. Diamonds started to be discovered in places that De Beers had no historical connection to, and so there was a point at which De Beers was simply unable to control the supply, but that comes much, much later. That's a very sort of recent part of history, and De Beers has had to sort of retool, reconsider its business model, and they've done an effective job with that as well. But it's a really, really interesting corporate history, and I try to take the reader through some of that, although there are certainly some books out there that are dedicated exclusively to De Beers, and all very good.
Well, I really enjoyed a lot of the sort of nickel knowledge type additions to your book. Like, I had no idea about the provenance of a diamond is forever. And the impact upon that, for example, upon the Japanese market.
Yeah. So, yeah, the manipulation of supply is really, or demand rather, is really one of the remarkable parts of their sort of corporate story. Just the almost the manufacturing of demand. For example, when there were stones found in Siberia, following the Second World War, they were all, of course, De Beers rushed to sort of seize control of this new supply that was coming online. But many of the stones, although reasonably high quality, were small. And so what De Beers did rather quickly was create pieces of jewelry that utilized these small stones, these sort of high-quality small stones, and then, of course, very carefully, very strategically paid the stars of the day to be adorned in these at particular public events. And then within almost overnight, you had a new market created for something that never existed previously. And so everybody in the United States wanted to have these new pieces of jewelry that featured a series of small stones as opposed to one big stone. So overnight, they were able to, not overnight necessarily, but within a very short period of time, they were able to manipulate demand such that they had a new market for these stones that they otherwise wouldn't have had anything really to do with in the past. So really, again, they're that sort of corporate model, or their sort of approach to manipulating demand is every bit as interesting as it is. Their efforts to manipulate supply. And the Diamond is Forever slogan is also an interesting story that comes out of a 1947 slogan coined by an advertising agency in New York City called NWA or Ensign. This is at a point when De Beers was not welcome into the United States, and so they were dealing sort of with an ad agency, but the ad agency would actually have to come to South Africa periodically to interact directly with the De Beers executives. So this is something that's created in a way that's independent of sort of De Beers' direct involvement. The company, of course, quickly picks up on this as a motto, but it's so much more than a motto because it again sort of manipulates the way diamonds are bought and sold, because now the idea is that you should never forget, you should never resell in a way the diamond. I mean, it has to be passed on from generation to generation and generation. And there's been some interesting articles written about the used diamond market, how you pay so much for a diamond, but it has so little value on the used market, and that's because consumers perceive it to be sort of tainted. You couldn't imagine buying a used diamond for your loved one. I mean, that would be so dishonest, and
that would be a slap in the face.
Exactly, which is of course absurd because nobody can tell whether a diamond's been worn. I mean, but again, this goes back to the sort of marketing genius. There's a book that came out recently called The Engagements by Courtney Sullivan. Which I confess I own but have not read yet, that sort of historical fiction kind of takes you through this whole history of how the slogan was coined. There was actually a woman who coined the slogan, Frances Garrity, and how she sort of struggled under the glass ceiling for years, even after creating this slogan that's been so durable. So interesting stuff.
Well, we've talked about the development of diamonds from the top, but another thing about your book is it's a wonderfully evocative and detailed analysis of the work process itself. So how did Africans, obviously De Beers could not have succeeded without African labor.
Sure.
So what was the labor process and how did Africans become involved? Initially, another thing that really struck me is initially Africans were involved in the prospecting business and the boom, not exactly on an equal level with the white prospectors, but they definitely had some input, but then they quickly became subservient and marginalized in terms of reaping the benefits from the diamond industry, but they certainly were instrumental in harvesting the diamonds. So what's the labor process? How did Africans become positioned the way they seem to have been positioned?
Sure. I think that you're referring to South Africa, where so quickly the Africans were involved, perhaps not...
Right, South Africa.
Yeah, not necessarily as equal partners in this process, but certainly as viable actors in this history, and prospecting and working their own claims, purchasing their own claims and working those either in conjunction with other Africans or sometimes alone. And so quickly they become marginalized in this process. It has a lot to do with the presence of a number of white miners, white rushers in a way, they're not even sort of formal mine workers yet, who converged upon the diamond deposits in South Africa. And then, of course, this is all set against the layer of, a backdrop of racialism or racism. And so quickly they identify that there are too many laborers, too many small claims. So what's originally a business decision becomes heavily infused with sort of racist notions of the day. And so the whites need to prevail in this scenario. And the white, generally most of the white individuals involved in this process or at least some of them, have more capital available to them. And so quite quickly they realize that this whole process needs to be industrialized. They need to move away from shovel mining, essentially, on these small claims with using sort of very inefficient methods. And, of course, there are only a handful of these industrialists who are well-heeled enough to transition the mines from extremely rudimentary labor to more mechanized labor. And over the course of this process, you have whites who are sort of pushed to the margins as well and end up in very sort of, in a way, subservient positions, but appeal to these sort of emerging corporate giants on racial grounds, that they should be treated differently because they are, of course, after all, their racial brethren. And as long as there's, as long as the African labor force continues to be available to, or sort of, as long as African workers are available to these sort of emerging corporate giants, they're comfortable with slightly preferential treatment for white workers. So white workers are spared some of the more egregious abuses, like these sort of full body searches upon entering and exiting the mines on each shift. And eventually this transitions into the compound system, in which black workers are fully contained within this sort of mining space. They move back and forth between a mine and a fenced, in fact, roofed-in compound, so that they can't escape at any moment during this whole process. And so, again, you'd have to argue that the sort of general transition from manual labor to more mechanized labor, in conjunction with these sort of heavily racist sentiments and sympathies within this relatively small and rapidly changing space, eventually shape the way that shape the sort of differential treatment that whites and blacks receive by these emerging companies, who so quickly consolidate control of the mines until just De Beers ends up emerging within a very, very short period of time. So what begins as a very sort of democratic process turns into a monopolistic process within a matter of a few decades. Elsewhere on the continent, I mean, you see this duplicated, but of course, much of this is going on post the Berlin Conference in 1884, 1885, and the subsequent subjugation of most of Africa. So this is playing out in very sort of similar environments in terms of the power relations between Africans and Europeans. But of course, in the same way, Africans serve as the backbone of the diamond industry in Africa. The profits are made on their backs. I will say, this is not to defend the diamond industry in Africa, but even during the colonial period, but vis-a-vis other corporate entities, the diamond companies tended to pay a little bit better, tended to be provide services, accommodations, food security in ways that other companies weren't necessarily able to or willing to. So most of the diamond mining operators were reasonably appealing to African laborers, who of course weren't necessarily interested in working for any colonial corporate entity, but forced to choose because of the tax situation, the taxes that the colonial powers imposed. Diamond mines were reasonably attractive places to work, and they were never, I shouldn't say never, but in most cases they were never lacking for African laborers, which is why in many reasons mechanization was forestalled, because African labor was African manual labor was extremely inexpensive, in part due to the political economies of colonial spaces. But on the other hand, it provided employment for a number of people. And in the case of De Beers, this ends up being a reasonably good place to work, all things considered. I mean, this is as you move into the apartheid period, which is, of course, is a very violent and inequitable period for black South Africans. But nonetheless, De Beers is a place where Africans can find employment, perhaps better working conditions, although very challenging working conditions, of course, but better compensation, so on and so forth, than in some other areas. Again, this is not to suggest that these were ideal spaces in which to earn a living, but nonetheless, the diamond industries, diamond companies overall treated their workers better in a paternalistic way in many cases than some of the other corporate entities operating in Africa during the colonial period.
I'd like to move on a bit to outside of Southern Africa, diamond mining and processing elsewhere, in particular Sierra Leone, which I think has become the focal point for blood diamonds. How did Sierra Leone get this reputation? And I'd like to follow up probably later with sort of discussing that in relation to the Kimberley process and processes of mechanization versus alluvial mining.
Okay.
But first, why is Sierra Leone sort of the ground zero of the blood diamond concept and actually, in fact, in myth and reality?
Sure. The diamond mining in Sierra Leone has a long history, and I think you'd, in order to begin to understand why it became sort of the epicenter of the blood diamond phenomenon, you'd have to go back into the colonial period. And relatively early on, the British, in many respects, threw their hands up and realized that they couldn't control the industry in a way that it was controllable in some other places. You also had a large number of Lebanese, due to longstanding sort of immigration practices into West Africa, who were particularly savvy and who identified these opportunities very early on, but always had a slightly different agenda than did the British, for example, or even local operators. And so the point of that is that you had a number of different entities operating within a single or reasonably expansive space, but still within a single colony. The stones are almost exclusively alluvial. And what that means is essentially there's very easy access to them. They're mostly superficial, which is problematic if you're trying to safeguard and control your these diamond resources as head of state or as a colonial administrator, so on and so forth. It's virtually impossible, even in today's age, and certainly it was the case decades ago. If some listeners may be familiar with Graham Greene's book, The Heart of the Matter. That's set in 1949, I believe. So already you can see the sort of chaos associated with the Sierra Leonean diamond fields. And so it's in many respects not surprising that this becomes such an uncontrollable, violent scenario post-independence, when the British pull out, although the British hadn't been doing much to sort of quell all the unrest in the mining regions. So they were trying to benefit or profit in any way they could from the revenues that were being generated from diamonds, and of course didn't want any sort of larger scale uprising within the colony. But on the other hand, they didn't do a lot to leave the Sierra Leonean fields in any sort of manageable shape when they decolonized. The Angolan case is interesting because, of course, in Angola becomes the next sort of blood diamond center, and they have a very different colonial history. They have a monopolistic company, Diamant, which I mentioned previously, and characterized by virtually no unrest during the colonial period. It's only immediately afterwards that Angola's diamonds become sort of the source of or fuel. The fighting in that setting, and so you have very different histories, or at least colonial histories, producing essentially the same scenario, in large part due to the introduction of a great number of foreign operators, foreign players, foreign entities, but also really, really expansive alluvial fields that are impossible to sort of police or control. So these are some of the elements that some of the undesirable elements. If you happen to be a premier of state and want diamond deposits that are easily controllable and accessible to only a small number of people rather than to just about everyone.
Well, that brings me to a point you raised some earlier about, relatively speaking, the diamond industry has been fairly cognizant of these inequities and injustices, and this led to the Kimberley process. Could you tell us what the Kimberley process is and what you think are its strengths and weaknesses, and how effective has it been in I guess the term is cleaning the diamond industry.
Sure. Yeah. The Kimberley process has been very controversial. Essentially what it is it grew out of these two blood diamond scenarios with Angola and Sierra Leone, the international community became increasingly aware that diamonds were in fact playing a central role in perpetuating or deepening these conflicts, one in Angola and one in Sierra Leone. And a series of investigative reports by the United Nations and some independent entities were very sort of revealed a great number of illegal activity, international legal activity with the related to the smuggling and the exit of stones from these respective places that were contravening policies, regulations, etc., that had been established. So the idea was that they needed something more strict, more stringent. And so the industry, along with sort of the United Nations, leaders of foreign governments, identified that this was actually in their best interest as well, because there was this there was always the specter of a boycott, analogous to the way that fur was boycotted in the 1980s. And into the 1990s. And so the diamond industry was, of course, extremely scared about that prospect. And so they joined these sort of unlikely partners in a way, joined forces along with some very, very important and very key efforts by some NGOs, in particular PAC, Partnership Africa Canada, to essentially formulate a system in which every stone that comes out of the ground needs to be certified. And so the idea was that each stone will be traceable as it works its way through the diamond chain, and stones from particular places would not be admitted into these sort of closed conduits or closed chains. So very simplistic on one hand, reasonably hard to implement on the other. The Kimberley process, in some respects, and this is highly debated, its efficacy and whether it was worth all the trouble and whether it's worth maintaining. But nonetheless, it's perhaps arguably the best system we have, because we don't have another one right now. In many respects, the Kimberley process came along at the right time, because these wars in Sierra Leone and Angola were ending, or just about to end. And so in some respects, it's awfully coincidental that the Kimberley process is implemented at a time when these respective conflicts are ending, and so it looks like the Kimberley process was perhaps more effective than it was. Nonetheless, there were elements of it that, or aspects of the Kimberley process that did deny some of the rebel groups operating in these respective scenarios access to funds, at least through legal channels, by putting their stones in sort of formal, quote-unquote, clean channels. Of course, there were many buyers who were willing to purchase the stones outside of these channels, but nonetheless, it made it more difficult for them. Going forward, there have been some instances where the Kimberley process has denied individual countries the opportunity to participate in the formal diamond industry. They've been relatively rare, but again, in part because the sort of signature wars have ended at this point. So these were sort of minor infractions in countries that aren't major producers, Ghana, for example. The problem with the Kimberley process is that the definition of blood diamonds that the Kimberley process adopted was extremely narrow. So it requires a rebel entity that's fighting an established or instituted government to overthrow or destabilize the government. And so, for example, the most currently, the biggest issue with the Kimberley process is the case of Zimbabwe. So Zimbabwe, recently, there were relatively recently a large deposits discovered in Zimbabwe, and the idea is that the Kimberley process is either toothless or powerless, depending on your perspective, to prevent the sale of these stones internationally. Initially, they sanctioned them, the Zimbabwean government, and forbade the sale of these stones. But that it was quickly overturned, and to a certain extent, you can understand why. On one hand, if you read the Kimberley process strictly, essentially it has no authority to ban the Zimbabwean government from selling its stones, because there's no rebel party that's utilizing the stones to overthrow the Mugabe regime in this case. On the other hand, of course, the Mugabe regime has been implicated for human rights abuses now for some time, and the idea that the government would be emboldened or empowered as a result of the sale of these stones is a prospect that doesn't sit well, of course, with a number of people. I think people need to keep in perspective or keep in mind, though, that the Kimberley process can't do anything more than perhaps the political process has. In other words, people who follow Southern Africa will know that despite Mugabe's excesses, there's still a strong degree of support going back to his days as a freedom fighter, as a liberation fighter in Southern Africa to overthrow the white regime in what was then Rhodesia. And so if there's still a great deal of support by Southern African nations for Mugabe, that also means there's a great deal of support by diamond-producing nations for Southern Africa, for Mugabe, as many Southern African nations are diamond-producing nations. So it's a little unrealistic to expect that the Kimberley process is going to single-handedly topple the Mugabe regime, for example, or cut off a key revenue supply in a way that we haven't. I mean, Mugabe's not been overthrown either domestically, internally, or internationally. And so I think some of the frustration is well-meaning and completely comprehensible, but on the other hand, perhaps unfounded or unrealistic that the Kimberley process was going to be able to do much more than sort of regional or international political processes have been able to, or domestic for that matter.
Well, that brings me to sort of, we're winding up here, sort of the issue that it became clear to me that it's as much a matter of political will as it is of enforcement. You mentioned how Botswana and Namibia, for example, have a reputation for being more in accordance with the Kimberley process than, say, the mining operations elsewhere on the continent. I wonder if that's because Botswana and Namibia are largely mechanized and industrialized, whereas the alluvial and craft mining industries are much harder to control. But that being said, I really like the fact that your book ends on a relatively optimistic note. Mm-hmm. And why do you have a sense of optimism about the future? And then I'm going to put you on the spot, because you never really answer the question that's opened your book, knowing what you know now. And
sure.
you can plead the fifth. Would you buy a diamond?
Sure. Well, I'll have time to think about that. Certainly both Namibia and Botswana benefit as a result of particular historical circumstances. This is something I could walk through in the book, that the deposits in Namibia weren't, or the deposits in Botswana weren't uncovered until after independence. So that gave the nation an opportunity to manage these resources as it saw fit, and it has done so, I think you could argue, very prudently. In Namibia, Namibia didn't become an independent country until South Africa granted it essentially autonomy or independence. So there are some historical circumstances that have lent themselves to the success that both of these countries have had in managing their deposits. But I think in large part you hit on the important factors here, that these are largely mechanized operations. They're in very, very inaccessible places. In the case of Namibia, offshore, which, for example, enabled the MPLA government in Angola to fight against the UNITA rebels, arguably indefinitely. I mean, its major resource that was fueling its side of the conflict was miles offshore, whereas UNITA was trying to protect deposits, much more accessible deposits inland. I think small populations are also a factor in both Namibia and Botswana. They have many, many fewer people that they need to keep happy with the revenues and the resources that they've derived from their respective deposits. But there's no clear-cut answer. There could have been very highly corrupt governments that had emerged in both these settings that could have managed their diamond resources in a very different way. So there's no sort of formula that indicates to us how particular diamond resources are going to be managed by particular governments. Moving to your concluding question, perhaps. I think I'd say yes. Yes, I would buy a diamond, knowing what I know now. In part because of the optimism that you cited, with which I closed the book. I think the channels. I think Africa's diamonds are by and large clean, if you will. I think the industry in many different countries has become much more broadly beneficial. I think there have been historically marginalized populations, such as women, for example, who are playing an increasingly important role, albeit still very small, role in the diamond industry. In South Africa, we've seen more Black South Africans participate at higher levels within the industry. So perhaps if you came along in 2014 and took a peek or a look at the industry, it might not be overly encouraged. But if you think about its history, I think it's heading in the right direction, even if only gradually. So I do believe that for the most part, if you were to purchase an African diamond, and I think consumers should be aware from where their diamonds come, and that's a sort of consumer responsibility. That purchase is most likely going to benefit a particular African country, African community, African individual now in a way that even 20 years ago that was much less likely to be the case.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Cleveland. I've been speaking with Professor Todd Cleveland, teaches history at Augustana College. We've been talking about his book, Stones of Contention, A History of Africa's Diamonds, published by Ohio University Press and Swallow Press. And I'll give you the URL for that again. It's www.ohioswallow.com. One word, OHIOSWALLOW. And I really encourage people who are interested in this topic to pick up Todd's book. It's well written, it's concise, and one thing I really like, he was brave to answer the question he poses, but he poses it to you, the reader, yourself. Thank you very much for your time, and I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Jim.